Presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. It's Friday. Happy weekend to you. And that being Friday, our day will be anything goes Friday, although there are a couple of issues that I want to talk about. We will get into in some small amount of detail. Depression, money, economics, what's going on, you know, what's the future of the U.S. economy? But our first hour, as always, Senator Bernie Sanders with us. Bernie Sanders, one of two independents in the House of Representatives, in the United States Senate. He was the longest serving member, independent member of the House of Representatives in that body's history. The senator from Vermont, I think of Bernie Sanders as America's senator. His website is sanders.senate.gov if you want to check it out. And Bernie will be taking your calls. Our toll-free number, 866-303-2270 after our first break. And also you can drop by airamerica.com or tomhartman.com, drop into our live chat room and participate and say hi. And again, Bernie's site, sanders.senate.gov. Welcome, Bernie Sanders.
Tom, it's good to be with you.
It's always great having you here, Senator. Higher education, I understand, is some good stuff happening in this front.
Well, I know, Tom, that people in general get depressed about the political situation, but I think we got to know that on occasion some good things happen. And actually today a very significant piece of higher education legislation was passed, probably the most significant higher ed bill passed in many, many decades. And I am on the committee that worked on that bill. Senator Ted Kennedy of Massachusetts, the chairman of the committee, did a really good job on that. And let me just tell the listeners what is in that bill. At a time when the middle class is finding it increasingly difficult to afford college, what this bill did is raise Pell Grants, which is the largest source of direct financial aid to middle-income and lower-income students in America, from $4,300 to $5,400 over a five-year period. It's going to be phased in, but it'll be a significant increase in Pell Grants and an expansion of their program. More people will be eligible for that program. So that's a step forward. The second thing that the bill did is right now people who are borrowing money to go to college pay 6.8%. This bill, again, over a four-year period, will lower that interest rate from 6.8 to 3.4%, cut it in half. That's going to mean significant savings to middle-class people as well. The other thing that it did, which we worked very, very hard on, is come up with a quite comprehensive loan forgiveness program. And that means that if you work in the public sector, broadly defined, that is, if you work for government in any capacity, if you work in education, if you work in law enforcement, if you're in the military, if you are a doctor working in a nonprofit hospital or a community health center, a nurse in the same boat, a dentist in the same boat, if you are working for an environmental group that is nonprofit, if you're working for legal aid, if you work in any, and they can be different jobs over a 10-year period, you will then see your loans forgiven at the end of 10 years.
Hmm.
And that's a pretty big deal. And what that does is going to give a lot of middle class and working class people a lot more career opportunity and choice than they currently have. Because if you graduate from school deeply in debt, often you got to search out a job which you may or may not like, but which pays you the kind of salary that enables you to pay off that debt. And now if people want to go into a job, maybe you want to be a child care worker, maybe you want to be a teacher, it may not pay you a whole lot of money, but if you're in one or another public sector type jobs for 10 years, at the end of that period, your loan is going to be forgiven. So that's a pretty
deal,
and I'm proud of that. It'll help a lot of families, and it'll also, I think, encourage a lot of young people to get into those areas of society, working with children, working with the disadvantaged, working in education, working in law enforcement, working in public interest law, areas where we need a lot of bright young people, I think it will encourage them to choose those vocations. So
this is going back to the worldview that we had post New Deal, from Franklin Roosevelt up until Ronald Reagan started dismantling it, that we drive things from the bottom up, that demand drives the economy, not supply, that investing in our people and in our infrastructure builds a strong country rather than just waiting for millionaires and billionaires to decide what they're going to do.
Right.
It's so gratifying to see this shift.
Yeah, and this is a big deal. And, you know, it means to say that right now, if a young person wants to go graduate college and work for an environmental group, doesn't pay a whole lot of money. But if you're in the public sector for 10 years, your debts are going to be forgiven from college. And so I'm excited about it. I think this is a step forward. And I raise this issue because I know that many people are demoralized about the political process, but I do want them to know that occasionally some good things are happening. There was a bill that was passed in the Senate yesterday, another bill, dealing with veterans issues. And I'm on the Veterans Committee, so this is an issue that we focus on and I feel very strongly about as somebody, you know, who sees what veterans are going through and the fact that the government has in many ways turned its back on veterans despite all the rhetoric coming from the White House. But I'm happy to say that yesterday a veterans bill was passed, which will significantly increase funding for the VA, which hopefully will end some of the waiting lines that exist in VA clinics and hospitals all over this country, which will try to do justice for the wounded soldiers coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan. So we have seen a major increase in veterans funding. I think Bush had indicated that he might veto this bill, but I don't think he will. I don't think he will do that at all. This is a step forward because no matter what our view may be on the war, and I think listeners know that I voted against that war and want our troops home as soon as possible, we cannot forget the men and women who have been wounded and suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder or traumatic brain injury or whatever it may be, and they deserve the best care that they can get. And this legislation will put money into their needs. So that's an issue that we are working on.
Now, you had put a hold on Jim Nussle's
nomination.
Maybe we should explain who he is.
What a hold is the senator has the opportunity, in a sense, to stop action on a piece of legislation. President Bush nominated Jim Nussle, who I know fairly well because he was in the House with me for 16 years, was a congressman from Iowa. Was chairman of the conservative Republican, was chairman of the Budget Committee for, I believe, 6 years. A very smart guy, but a very, very conservative guy. And I put a hold on that nomination and kind of forced the debate on Tuesday, which is a 3-hour debate, just to discuss why I was opposed to Nussle. And the reason is that I get sick and tired of hearing this president of the United States tell the American people how great the economy is, right? Every time you turn on the TV, he is saying the economy is robust, the economy is growing, the economy is just doing great. And the point that I made and others made said, Mr. President, what world are you living in? Yes, for your millionaire and billionaire friends, the economy is, in fact, doing very
well. That's the world he's living in.
Yeah. Right.
He's got a $24 million trust fund, and he wants to go out and fill his coffers when he leaves the White House and make speeches for money.
That's exactly it, Tom. I mean, that is exactly it. He's living in a bubble, and he speaks to people who are incredibly wealthy. And for those people, they come in to him, I guess. They say, hey, Mr. President, you're doing a great job. Economy is just great. I'm a CEO. You know, I'm making $25 million a year. Mr. President, keep it up. Give us more tax breaks. But to keep saying that at a time when we have seen 5 million more Americans slip into poverty, when we have seen median income for working-age families decline by about $2,400 since Bush has been president, when some 8 million people have lost their health insurance, when we have more and more people in this country who are hungry, when the gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider, it just pains me. I'm sick and tired of hearing this guy tell us how great the economy is because he's way out of touch with what working people and middle-income people are experiencing. So we had this debate. I thought it was a good debate, not to nobody's surprise. You know, we lost on the nomination. I think it was 69-24. But I just wanted to make the point that, you know, while people can disagree about trade policies and raising the minimum wage nationally. Although, you know, we can have disagreements. We should not go around perpetrating an Orwellian myth out there and keep telling people how great the economy is when more and more people are just struggling to keep their heads above water.
Yeah, it's really true. And Jim Nussel, one of many Republicans who just, you know, really very much are representing the interests of big corporations and inherited wealth, period. And they think that that's what represents the strength of America. And you and I think it's the working people of this country.
That's exactly right.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment here on the Tom Hartman radio program. Bernie will be taking your calls right after this. His website, sanders.senate.gov. We're at tomhartman.com and airamerica.com. 16 minutes past the hour. Stick around.
Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. Jim Tur's Population Control song, yes. 21 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Brunch with Bernie, our segment. And Bernie, ready for phone calls here?
Yep.
Okay, Rich in Birmingham, Alabama. You're on the line with Bernie Sanders.
Good morning, guys. It seems to me that one of the big problems we have in this country with the middle class and the poor is a lack of financial literacy. Many Americans, we have a negative savings rate, carry $7,000 to $10,000 in consumer debt. We've read about all the foreclosures. Why can we not make personal finance or financial literacy part of the core curriculum in the public schools? And just one other point, you know, poor kids are surrounded by people that have not succeeded financially. Wealthy kids are surrounded by people that, you know, we need to break that barrier and give them examples and give them the skills to get out of there. And that's all I got. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, well said, Rich. And Bernie, let me just toss in. I've always thought it weird that people graduate from high school not knowing how to change a baby's diaper, not knowing how to maintain a good relationship with a spouse, and not knowing how to balance a checkbook. And yet those are all things that most people are going to have to do at some point in life. But they all know when Columbus discovered America, which is like, you know, so what?
Rich makes a very good point. We have a real problem with financial literacy. And you will have a lot of predatory-type people who take advantage of that ignorance. As you know, Tom, we've talked about this in the past. Young people are bombarded, among other things, with huge numbers of solicitations from these credit card companies, zero interest, and of course you don't read the small print, and young people go deeply into debt because they don't understand interest rates, they don't understand credit cards, and they don't even have a sense of budgeting. I think Rich is exactly right, and I would like to see more curriculum in elementary schools and high schools about financial literacy.
Yeah, well said. Let's see here. Randy in Oakland, California. You're on live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. Hi, Bernie. Thanks for the show. Absolutely great that you guys are speaking so well from this side. Hey, please help me become less jaded and less cynical. I've donated to progressive causes. We've gotten the right progressive people in power in many, many, many states and such, and I'm worried and spent so much time thinking about the war and where we're headed. And it just makes me think that these powerful oil companies that essentially are larger and more powerful than the U.S. government can just ask the government to do their bidding for them. And it just makes me think that all the rest, all of what we're doing is window dressing compared to the big things. When the oil companies say, hey, we need to grab this oil before the Chinese do, you guys need to go do it for us.
Well, Randy, yeah. I think, you know, you put your finger on the dominant political issue of the time. It's not new news. I mean, it's gone on for a long, long time. But it's not something the media will discuss very often, and that is the extraordinary power that big money has over what goes on in Washington and state capitals all over this country. We can document pretty clearly, in the old Congress especially, that virtually every single piece of legislation that came down the pike, and I think Tom DeLay was the former majority leader there in the House of Representatives, was very clear about it. If you want your legislation to move, you're a large corporation, we'll move it for you when you make the appropriate amount of campaign contributions. And legislation after legislation was there designed just to represent the very wealthiest people in this country. That's why we gave hundreds of billions of dollars in tax breaks to the richest 1%, but somehow or another we couldn't raise the minimum wage. That's why we had trade policy written by corporate America so they could throw American workers out on the street when they moved to China and so forth and so on. So that is the issue. That is the issue. But I would urge you, you know, not to keep your eye on the prize and take a long view of things. The world is not going to be changed tomorrow. We are making some progress. I mentioned earlier in the show about a significant educational bill, which the banks don't like because we're doing away with the subsidies they got, yet middle class and working families are going to like it because we increased Pell Grants and lowered student loans and put in debt forgiveness. We raised the minimum wage. Did it go high enough? No. But there are a lot of employers out there who are not happy about it, but it was done anyhow. We have now expanded health care for children. Bush is threatening to veto that legislation, but it's progress. So to answer Randy's question, he's absolutely right. That is the major dynamic of American politics. Big money has enormous power over what goes on in Washington. They have enormous power over the media and what the American people see, hear, and read. That's the reality. And we've got to work on it day after day after day. That includes public financing of elections so we can break the stranglehold that big money has. But don't get discouraged. You got to keep fighting. We got to mobilize people. We got to educate people. That's a moral obligation that we have.
And this is one of those areas where reaching across, I mean, the Green Party is very, very active in these issues as well. And you can participate in the Green Party and the Democratic Party, for example. Or would you disagree?
Nope. That's...
Okay. And of course, you're an independent. There you go. 27 minutes past the hour. We're talking with Senator Bernie Sanders. Brunch with Bernie. Bernie Sanders taking your calls. Sanders.Senate.gov is website. AirAmerica.com. TomHartmann.com. Our websites. 866-303-2270. We'll be right back.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call 866-303-2270.
Four minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartmann radio program. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour, the first hour of every Friday. It seems for many years here now, we've every Friday had Senator Sanders on. It's such an honor and a pleasure. Bernie Sanders taking your calls. 1-866-303-2270. Mike in Queens, New York, you are on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Two quick things, Senator. Undoubtedly, you never got the memo that the economy is doing real good from the Bush administration. Now, the Navy's downsizing their anti-shipping missile systems. They're getting rid of the phalanx, and they're putting missile on their ships. So instead of selling those phalanx systems, would end up being sold to the Arabs, why can't they put them on our nuclear power plants?
To protect the plants against the terrorist attack?
Yeah, because I live over here in New York City. If that plant just north of us gets hit, the city would be uninhabitable.
No, you're absolutely right. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that, Mike. We have a nuclear plant in the state of Vermont, which in the last month has had a couple of problems. I introduced legislation, which has just been introduced in the House yesterday, which would require, among other things, a major independent inspection for all older nuclear power plants that want to expand their capacity or lengthen their terms of existence, how long they stay in operation. But you raise an important issue, and that is the vulnerability of nuclear power plants to terrorist attacks and whether or not we are defending them as well as we might. And that's an important issue.
Now, apparently, when Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was interrogated, this was in the 9/11 Commission report, that he said that the first target for the planes, the hijacked planes, was going to be Indian Point nuclear power plant north of New York.
I think that's what Mike is talking about.
Yeah, and he decided not to because he just assumed that there would be missile batteries protecting it, and that he wouldn't be able to get a plane into it. And to this day, they are all unprotected. And this is not like, you know, us telling the terrorists something they don't already know. The New York Times has reported on this, but it's not a good situation.
No.
Scott in Cleveland, Ohio, you're live with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. Listen, Bernie, I have a lot of respect for you, but I just want to reiterate the frustrations of the American people, and I want to home it down to exactly one point, and that is our civil liberties. How badly exactly does the Constitution have to be shredded before some Democrat or independent says, that's it? And getting ruled 2 weeks ago by a party that doesn't even have a majority and hearing about how they're going to fix it right when they get back, and I've heard nothing all week. Please don't give me a political answer. Please say somebody's going to save the Constitution. Thank you very much.
I think Scott's referring to the FISA bill. But...
Yeah, well, no, he has a very good point. And I would simply say, as somebody who helped lead the effort against the USA Patriot Act when I was in the House and voted against it and voted against all of Bush's attacks on the Constitution, including this FISA bill, he's right. I think the Democrats played a very bad role in that legislation. They gave the Bush administration even more than they wanted. I think what you are seeing, I don't know if he thinks this is a political answer or not, it just, that Gonzalez resigned didn't happen by accident. And people say, well, what are you doing? Well, Gonzalez resigned because of hearings that were held, investigations that were held by people like John Conyers, Patrick Leahy, and others who began for the first time in 6 years to start holding the Bush administration accountable on a number of issues, including their attacks on civil liberties. It is my hope, and I can't speak for every member of the United States Senate, but I certainly hope that we will revisit issue by issue by issue in areas where Bush has undermined our Constitution and move forward to protect civil liberties. Now, the truth of the matter is that terrorism is a serious business. We talked a moment ago about the dangers if an attack ever took place against the nuclear power plant. We saw what happened in Germany just yesterday. You do have people who want to do harm to people in the United States, as much harm as they can. We have to defend the American people, and we have to do good law enforcement. But I believe now, and I've always believed, that you can protect the American people. You could be smart in fighting international terrorism and do that in a way which protects our constitutional rights and our civil liberties. And that's what I'm pledged to do. And this is an area we have got to focus on.
And in fact, if we give up our Constitution, we've lost.
Right, but I just do want to say to the caller who, you know, expresses legitimate frustration, Gonzalez did not resign by accident.
Right.
Don't think that is insignificant.
There are things happening. Andre in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders. Then thanks for listening to WOIC there.
Thank you, Tom. Senator Sanders, I have a question in regards to, well, let me tell you a story real quick and I'll give you the question. Me and my wife were watching television. I live in South Carolina. We love North Carolina. We go there all the time. We were looking at North Carolina news and, they've gone to the National ID program. Now, some of these people received a driver's license with a picture of North America, and those people were very upset. And now they're looking at, they think there are RFID tags inside their driver's license. Now, this is straight out of the Shared Prosperity Partnership, Security Prosperity Partnership, North American Union. every time Americans talk to senators about it, they act like they don't know what it is. But actually, their agenda's going through. I just don't understand. If we aren't America, then the Constitution stands for nothing. Mm-hmm. And how can he sign a partnership without it being ratified by the Senate and the House, and therefore the American people, with other foreign governments? This is treason. And, you know, I know that you're a great senator. I'm an independent as well. But I feel that the American people will hold Democrats responsible for complicity in this action.
Okay. Andre, I'm, to be honest with you, not familiar with what's going on in North Carolina, but the president historically has had, up until, by the way, a few months ago, what we call free trade, the ability to negotiate trade agreements on his own and then bring it to the Congress for ratification. That is now expired, which means that Congress now will be involved in negotiating trade agreements from the ground on up, which is something that I think is long overdue. I very strongly believe that in terms of our international trade agreements, that NAFTA, Permanent Normal Trade Relations with China, CAFTA, other agreements were pushed by the Bush administration and previous administrations at the behalf of large multinational corporations who like these trade agreements primarily because it makes it easier for them to throw American workers out on the street, move abroad, hire people at low wages, and bring their products back into this country. I think you are touching on other issues, and your concern is, will laws from other countries, will the WTO, for example, a rather secretive organization in Geneva, Switzerland, be able to make laws which impact the American people? That is an absolutely legitimate concern, and I share that, which is why you will see myself and a number of other senators involved in trying to reform our trade policies.
Connie in Orange County, California, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. Currently, corporations have more rights than a natural person. Humboldt County has just made corporations a non-person. This acts to limit Humboldt County's big corporations in Humboldt County, big corporations' ability to influence elections and some other issues, and it brings local control back. I'd like to laud Humboldt County for their foresight and ask if this could be brought to a national level. I think it's a hugely valuable tool, and I'd like to say thank you for all you two do. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, Tom, you wrote a book on that issue, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It's called Unequal Protection. Yeah.
So you could say a few words on it.
Well, there are over 100 towns in Pennsylvania that have declared that corporations don't have First Amendment, Fourth Amendment, Fifth Amendment, and 14th Amendment rights, in that they're not persons in their towns. Tom Lindsay of the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF.org, is the leader of this thing. There's a bunch of groups working on this. It's a hot topic, and it needs to be. It would be nice to see some legislative remedies, but ultimately we're going to have to overturn some Supreme Court rulings on this.
But bottom line here is, I think what Connie is saying is corporate America has enormous power, and they can be absolved from responsibility are doing some awful things, and these guys have got to be held accountable, and their power has got to be diminished.
Well, and one of the big problems, and Jefferson wrote about this, that corporations, up until the 1880s, a corporation couldn't exist for more than 40 years in any state in the United States. The theory being the founders didn't want any person or any institution to aggregate so much wealth over multiple generations that you would end up with, like in England, the landed gentry.
And now,
that's what has happened now.
The irony is now the distribution of wealth and income in the United States is now worse than it is in England, as it happens.
Yeah, in the United Kingdom, exactly. Yeah. And so we've exactly gone backward. And the corporate form, the misuse of the corporate form, since the 1880s is one of the things that's facilitated that as a consequence of this lousy 1886 Supreme Court decision. But anyhow, we'll get back to the callers right after this. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line with us. Sanders.Senate.gov, his website, ours, AirAmerica.com, TomHartmann.com. 45 minutes past the hour.
Truth in broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartmann Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
No, it's not. No, 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 no. We are still holding alive the dream of America and democracy in America. Our quote for the day, by the way, with special thanks to Sheldon and Fairlawn, from Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, 1776. Adam Smith wrote, "People of the same trade seldom meet together, even for merriment and diversion, without the conversation ending in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices." Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont, sanders.senate.gov, on the line with us. And Jim in Montana, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
From Missouri, or from Montana, did you say?
Yeah, that's what it says
right
here on the screen.
That's me. Yeah. I'm curious why, when they say there's no inflation, they always tag that with, but they're not including energy or food costs. And also, I'm curious how come there wasn't any rise in the unemployment after a whole city like New Orleans, which has got the population of Montana, disappears from the system.
Depending on the way this or that group looks at unemployment.
This goes back to your debates with Greenspan, doesn't it? I mean, you know how these guys are always just playing with the numbers?
Well, yeah, but also there are problems with how unemployment is calculated right now, in the sense that if you're working part-time, you're not part of the statistic. If you are in an area where unemployment is very high and you've given up looking actively for work, you are not counted. If you have a PhD and you're working in a McDonald's, you're counted as fully employed. So I think that issue, and it's been on my mind for a while, is something we want to take a look at to get a better sense of what is going on in terms of employment in America. I think we need to do some work on that.
Yeah, unemployment and underemployment as well.
Right.
Rick in Raleigh, North Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello there.
Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Good. I want to thank you both for your efforts on our behalf.
Thank you.
I would like to make a suggestion. I've listened to this show a lot and to both of you, and I haven't heard anything like this. The question is with regards to KBR and the non-bid contracts and the prices we're paying for truck drivers and everything else. I remember when the insurance companies brought out a new policy that was called a reasonable and customary fee. And I think that same policy, I think we should look at what the corporations did to us and turn it around on them. And we should now, when KBR presents a bill, we should say, well, we're only going to pay the reasonable and customary amount for that area. So what's the truck driver rate of pay for a truck driver in Iraq? And that's what we'll pay you. And if you pay someone else more than that, that's your problem.
Well, Rick, I think you raise a very interesting and important issue. I think you're beginning to see, finally, Congress take a hard look at some of these outrageous contracts that have been let in Iraq, where companies have been ripping off the taxpayers of the United States right and left, and that is unacceptable. You have situations where contracts have been given out with no bidding at all, and these corporations have just been as greedy as humanly possible, and they've been involved in fraud as well. So I think what we are going to try to do, and we talked about this last week, I believe, is bring a Truman-like commission to take a look at profiteering in the Iraq war, and I think it'll bring forth some interesting results.
Yeah, and at the same time, KBR has been reincorporated in the Cayman Islands, so they don't have to pay taxes, and Halliburton's talking about moving to the United Arab Emirates, where they only have to keep business records for 12 months. So it's amazing. Ken in Daytona Beach, Florida, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi, thank you. This is my favorite aspect of the show. Back to the first segment, Senator Sanders, you were talking about student loans and
yes,
loan forgiveness. If a student graduate goes to work and is working in the public sector, is he or she still paying the bills while she or he is working?
For the first 10 years, that would be the case.
So it still might be that they have to find a good-paying job.
Well, depending on their income, there is a maximum amount that they have to pay.
I got you.
Okay. So this is, I mean, it's not everything, but it is a significant step forward. And their interest rates will be lower than is currently the case.
Okay. Gary in Cheyenne, Wyoming. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Thank you. Frequently I hear people talk about the terrorists are out to kill Americans. I think it would be wise to consider that their motive isn't to kill Americans. They have a goal that is only their only avenue of accomplishing it. Same as I don't agree with our reason for going in Iraq, but we didn't go to Iraq supposedly to kill Iraqis. It just happens in the process of doing what we think we've killed, you know, a million Iraqis. I think it would be better to deal with the goals of the terrorists instead of their idea of this nonsense of them out to try to kill Americans. If they try to kill Americans, there's a lots of ways they could kill bigger quantities than they've done.
Well, Gary, I don't know that I quite agree with you. I think there are people out there who, if they could do significant damage and kill tens of thousands of Americans or more, they would in fact do that. The broader question is how we are effective in fighting international terrorism, whether the war in Iraq has made a difficult situation even worse, which I think it has. I think if you read the National Intelligence Estimate, what you find is that because of the war in Iraq, Al-Qaeda is expanding in Pakistan, in other countries around the world. Many of the lessons that learned in Iraq now are being applied in Afghanistan. So the real issue that we have got to deal with is how do we intelligently combat international terrorism, and it cannot only be done through military means.
Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders, sanders.senate.gov, his website. There's just a pile of useful information over there all the time, constantly updating. Check it out. Bernie Sanders, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom. Talk to you soon.
Great bye-bye. Talking to you. Thank you. 57 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-303-2270. Stick around.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour here on this Friday. Tom Hartman here with you. Get an email from Kim and Joyce. I not toss out last names here. I don't know if people want their names out. And it says, you guys are missing the fact that Fred Thompson is imminently electable. He is a heterosexual, white, Protestant, Southern male, and an actor. That's exactly who can get elected these days as a Republican. He is a threat. And they go on to say in the email, you know, we feel that Edwards is the most electable of the Democrats, plus he's the one who really is really concerned about the poor. Yes, he's rich now, but he earned it himself. He didn't inherit it or marry it, and all the other candidates are at least as rich. Why didn't we hear that said? Anyway, please take Fred Thompson more seriously as a threat. And it's interesting, last night, Louise and I reviewed or watched again, I guess, whatever, the Jay Leno thing. I had just seen the clips of it, so we decided to watch the whole thing, the interview with Fred Thompson. And Paul Gronke is, if I'm pronouncing that right, I hope I am, over at BlueOregon.com, a progressive blog here on the West Coast, points out, and very to the point, I mean, just the bullet points that as I was watching this, if you saw this thing, really quite amazing, is Fred Thompson was talking to Jay Leno, and Leno says, would you have gone into Iraq if you were president, you know, back in 2001? And Fred Thompson says, absolutely. He would have gone into Iraq. Why? Because Saddam Hussein was pursuing nuclear weapons. Say what? I mean, you know, it's like, you know, I can tell you, whatever this guy is smoking, I don't want it. I mean, it's like, So anyhow, he says Saddam Hussein was pursuing nuclear weapons, and that's why we had to go to war. We know that, by the way, that he was not. He also, Fred Thompson also said that our main opponent in Iraq is Al-Qaeda. And it's not. It's not Al-Qaeda. In fact, there was no Al-Qaeda in Iraq before we got there. And even now, the Al-Qaeda that's there is pretty much a homegrown variety. And it's a very, very small factor. He said that the recent elections in Iraq, the phrase he used, he said, those people who put ink on their fingers, was, quoting Thompson, the first time in history in that part of the world, end quote, from Thompson, that there had been elections in the Middle East. Well, what about Lebanon? What about Mauritania? What about Afghanistan? What about Israel? What about Palestine, the Palestinian territory? What about Yemen? They're even struggling in that direction. And then he goes on to say, well, we can't leave Iraq until we get the job done. And Jay says, well, what does that mean? And he kind of wanders around, and then he says, we got to pacify Iraq. They're sitting on all those oil reserves. Yes, he actually said that. And I was just astounded, you know, watching Fred Thompson with my mouth open going, I don't believe it. I don't believe that there's enough people in America who will drink this Kool-Aid. But then I have to tell you, in 1980, I said the same thing about Ronald Reagan. I was looking at Ronald, and so did most Americans, right? You know, up until the hostages were taken in the last couple of months of that election in 1980, when Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter, until the hostages were taken and Carter was unsuccessful in getting them released in Iran, Reagan was way behind in the polls because everybody in America considered him to be a right-wing fringe nutcase. And the hostages, on top of the economic consequences of the disaster in Iraq and all the borrowing and spending that had gone on Vietnam, and all the borrowing and spending that had gone on associated with that, eventually caught up with Carter and hurt him badly in that election. So anyhow, I just wanted to toss that out. It's Anything Goes Friday. There's a bunch of things that I'm going to toss out here over the course of the next 2 hours as topics you might want to chew on. But, you know, the Salon.com article yesterday is a really important one. Sidney Blumenthal writing over at Salon.com. On September 18th, 2002. Now, keep in mind, this is what? September, October, November, December, January, February, March, April. This is like 5-6 months before we attacked Iraq. CIA Director George Tenet briefed President George Bush in the Oval Office on top secret intelligence that Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction, according to two former senior CIA officers. And then he goes on to say Bush dismissed this as worthless. Tenet never brought it up again. This information, by the way, came from the Iraqi foreign minister, a member of Saddam's inner circle, and it was accurate in every detail, as Sidney Lewenthal points out. And that factoid, by the way, did not make its way into the National Intelligence Estimate in October 2002. And in my mind, the question is, why not? Did Bush say, George, you will not put that in the National... Did the White House edit the CIA's NIE? Or did the CIA edit it because Tenet was trying to suck up to George? Or was there some kind of consensus that we've got to fool the American people? I mean, that's what the Downing Street minutes show. Is that in June, July of 2002, in England, they were, you know, quite clear that the U.S. government, that the Bush administration was fixing the facts to support the policy that they were going to invade Iraq. At the same time, the Bush was running around saying, I don't know why you say I'm going to invade Iraq. I don't know. I don't want to invade Iraq. And yet they were planning on it. So anyhow, it's a lot out there. And, of course, George, at the APEC conference in Australia yesterday, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperation Conference, APEC, thanked his Austrian hosts for inviting him. There's a good story about this over at rawstory.com, for inviting him to this year's OPEC summit. And then he tries to walk out. He leaves the stage in a direction that will cause him to fall off the edge and literally go off a cliff, you know, or not literally, metaphorically, you know, fall and drop and fall a considerable distance. And so John Howard goes over and grabs him and says, no, Mr. President, the stairs are this way, and leads him across the podium in the other direction. So Anyhow, a lot on the table here. 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, TomHartmann.com if you want to drop into our live chat room, participate in our message boards. Also, AirAmerica.com if you want to participate in our blog. Joe in Key West, Florida. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing? It's good to talk to you.
Well, thank you, Joe.
I got a question I'd like to ask. I wonder why the AP Press or whoever is named Junior, if he's called George Senior, a cut and runner, because he damn sure cut and run from Iraq, didn't he?
Well, I think that was the essence of the conversation that they had in Woodward's book. You know, when Woodward said, do you ask your father for advice? And George said, no, I've got a higher father that I go to. I think he was dissing his dad. I think that there's been a long history of that kind of a competition between Bush and his father. And tragically, the psychodrama of the Bush family for a long time, frankly, has been played out in the United States not a good thing, just not a good thing. Elizabeth in Los Angeles, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Elizabeth.
Yes, Tom, thank you for taking my call. I have a theory, and then I'd like your comment. Hope I have time to finish the theory. The first desert storm, we let oil wells burn themselves out and quake because they couldn't be put out. We put them out all the time in Texas. Anyhow, go on.
Well, we did. I don't think we let them burn themselves out. But,
yeah, we did a lot because my son, not that he knew everything, but he was in Desert Storm. Anyhow,
right.
What my main thing is to get to Iran. So that happens. Then we go into Iraq, which we thought was going to be a cakewalk.
You mean getting to Afghanistan and then we go into Iraq.
Well, yeah, because of 9/11 and all that, and I don't even want to go into that because I don't believe in that. But anyhow... okay, so there we go into Iraq, thought we could get right through that. This whole thing is on the Saudis with controlling the oil and the Bush family. And this Valerie Plame that they supposedly outed because of her husband, no, she was an expert in Iran. She could speak Farsi. I think they knew years ago that they wanted to take all these countries' oil control and with the Saudis and the Bushes.
Yeah, Brewster Jennings was involved in counterproliferation with regard to Iran as well as other countries.
But I'm just saying Iran, and that's why now that's all you hear is the same junk that you heard before Iraq. And people have got to call the Capitol information number. It's 202-225-3121.
Elizabeth, absolutely. You call and let them know. I've been frankly surprised that we haven't been hearing them ginning up the war in Iran. I was predicting it was going to start this week. It hasn't. And now I think I've figured out why. I think the reason why they haven't started promoting the war in Iran is because they've got to get another $50 billion out of Congress for Iraq first. And once they've gotten the Democrats to roll over on that, and it looks like that's probably going to happen, then they'll go after Iran. So it'll probably be another month or two. We'll see. 16, do I sound cynical? 16 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartmann Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio.
It's our Anything Goes Friday. Welcome back. And just before we get to your phone calls, I just have to share this, our crazy alert for the day. So this is what happens when you merge state and religion. In Nepal, the government owns the airline, and the airline was having some technical problems with one of their 757 aircraft. And so they sacrificed two goats to appease Akash Bahirab, the Hindu sky god, following technical problems with one of the Boeing 757 aircraft, according to the official state-run airline of Nepal. The goats were sacrificed in front of the troublesome aircraft Sunday, Nepal's only international airport in Kathmandu, in accordance with Hindu traditions, an official said. It is common, in fact, they say, in Nepal to sacrifice animals like goats and buffaloes to appease different Hindu deities. Yeah. Well, another strong argument for the separation of church and state, at the very least. And by the way, I ended the last segment by just saying, you know, do I sound cynical? Please, no. I am not at all cynical about our political process. If I was, I would stop doing this program. I have great optimism about our political process. I have great optimism about our nation. I am, however, cynical about the people within the Bush administration and, by and large, within the Republican Party. And to some extent, some of the Democrats. I look at these guys and go, you know, why are they so afraid? Why, you know, when are they just going to wake up and say and realize that the American people want somebody to get out in front of this thing and say, sorry, we've had 5 years of being terrified and we're not going to be terrified anymore. Even if somebody comes to the United States and blows up a bomb in one of our cities or you know, does their worst, we're still not going to be terrified. We will deal with it. We've dealt with all kinds of horrible stuff in the history in the course of this nation, and we have come through it, and we have kept our values intact. We have kept our ideals intact. I mean, the British and the Canadians in 1812 burned the White House. George Bush goes on, he says, this is the first time we've ever been attacked on American soil. Nonsense! They burned the White House, and President James Madison, whose wife had to flee the White House the night before, and the only thing she could take with her was a picture of George Washington that she rolled up and stuck down her dress as Dolly Madison was fleeing the White House. And James Madison did not say, oh, we've got to do away with that Constitution. We've got to do away with the Bill of Rights. No, they said, we're fighting for the Constitution. And so the bottom line, I have great optimism because for the United States, because I know this is burned into our DNA, into our national DNA, and we are going through a period of national temporary insanity. It's been lasting about 5-6 years now and going on 7, and we will shake out of it. We always have. We've been through periods of temporary insanity in the past, the McCarthy era, another one. And we shook out of it. Finally, somebody stood up. Finally, what was it, Joe Welch, as I recall, Joe Walsh, stood up to Senator McCarthy and said, sir, have you no conscience? You know, finally somebody stood up to the bully and said, you're not going to terrify me. You're not going to terrify the American people anymore. Ain't going to happen. And there is just no doubt in my mind that that same kind of thing is going to happen. Somehow, somewhere, at some level, at some point. And frankly, I think it's going to be driven by us. And that's why I say, you know, the message, if you're going to contact your elected representatives, and there's a lot of important issues out there to talk about. But one of them is, you know, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. You know, you don't need to be afraid. Anyhow, 1-866-303-2270. Mary in Spokane, Washington. Is it Spokane or Spokane? I'm always mispronouncing it, and I always misremember it for the next time.
Hello.
Hi, Mary.
Okay, so I have kind of a moral dilemma. I had a job interview with a company that manufactures a really great learning tool for children. However, they manufacture this learning tool in China. And I asked the question, I said, well, look, you know, I have to ask a sensitive question here. You know, how are the working conditions of the people who manufacture this product? And do they use lead-based paint? And it was a very awkward situation, and I'm having a bit of a moral dilemma. I like the company, I like what they do, but there it is.
Right. Well, all of us confront that all the time. I mean, you know, you want to buy a PC right now. You can't buy a PC without it being either made in China or mostly made from parts in China. You know, General Motors cars have engines made in China. I mean, it's Yes, and I think at the level of this is something that we really need and we really have, you make the decision, you know, as a consumer to purchase what you're going to purchase. And as you did so brilliantly, Mary, you raised the issue with the company so that they'll start considering it. And then we get politically active and we say to our legislators, we want to start making these things in the United States again. We'd like to bring these jobs home. We'd like to bring the standards home. Let's do away with these insane free trade rules.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Now we're calling out to America.
Wake up.
Wake up. Don't be afraid. Join us. You know, it's interesting. Again, thinking back to watching Fred Thompson on Jay Leno and just this whole be afraid meme. You know, we've got to fight them over there so we don't have to fight them here. The question, Robert Kennedy raised a question during the Vietnam War. That I have not even heard any Democrat, I have not heard a single Democrat raise so far. I take that back. I believe there were a few Democrats in the House of Representatives and at least one senator. I might have been Russ Feingold. I'd have to go back and look who voted against the resolution to go into Afghanistan. I was opposed to our invading Afghanistan. And continue to think that it was a mistake. It was a criminal situation. We could have negotiated with the Afghanis to take custody of Mr. bin Laden, an international consortium of nations, have an international court like the Nuremberg trials. And the Afghan government had indicated that it was willing to turn bin Laden over to anybody except us, basically. And we should have gone along with it. I mean, now we've lost more than three quarters of the country of Afghanistan. I don't think most Americans even realize that. But Robert Kennedy raised the question, is it even moral? Is it even right for us to be fighting in a distant land if we assume for a moment that we actually need to be fighting in a distant land to protect ourselves from them? In other words, even if you bought the argument that Bush is selling, and that the Republicans are selling, and that many of the Democrats are selling, that, oh, we've got to be fighting over there. We've got to fight in Afghanistan to stop them from hurting us here. Even if you bought that argument, is that a moral argument to make? Consider this from a television interview with Robert Kennedy in, as I recall, 1967.
Now we've turned when we found that the South Vietnamese haven't given the support and are not making the effort. Now we're saying we're going to fight there so that we don't have to fight in Thailand. So that we don't have to fight in the west coast of the United States so that they won't move across the Rockies.
And then he continues.
I mean, do we have the right here in the United States to say that we're going to kill tens of thousands, make millions of people as we have, millions of people refugees, kill women and children as we have? There's 35,000 people without limbs in South Vietnam, 150,000 civilian casualties every year.
And by the way, we're looking at numbers that are roughly in that range in terms of the civilian casualties and damage in Iraq right now. Do we have the right? Robert Kennedy asking the question.
Thousands of children are killed because of our efforts. Do we have that right here in the United States to perform these acts because we want to protect ourselves so that we don't have, it's not a greater problem for us here in the United States? I very seriously question whether we have that right.
Now, see, this is, talk about the moral dilemma. Right. This is if you even keep in mind, this is fairly early on. Even if you assume that the war is of some protective value to the country, is bombing people the way to do it? Is it the moral and correct way to do it? much less the most effective way to do it. Bobby Kennedy continues.
And I think other people are fighting it. Other people are carrying the burden. But this is also our war. Those of us who stay here in the United States, we must feel it. When we use napalm and when a village is destroyed, civilians are killed, this is also our responsibility. This is a moral obligation and a moral responsibility for us here in the United States. And I think we've forgotten about that. And when we switched from one point of view to another, I think that we've forgotten about it. And I think that it should be discussed. And all of us should examine our own conscience of what we are doing in South Vietnam. It's not just the fact that we're killing North Vietnamese soldiers or Viet Cong. We're also responsible for tens and tens of thousands of innocent civilian casualties. And I think we're going to have a difficult time explaining it to ourselves.
Robert F. Kennedy, a profoundly and deeply moral man, a deeply religious Catholic, and somebody who seriously, I mean, seriously looked into the hellish depths in many regards of the issues that were raised by our involvement in Vietnam, and went way beyond the jingoism and the cliche and the rhetoric of the time, even beyond the Democratic rhetoric of the time, and asked the really hard questions. And it's what we need to be doing now as well, is moving forward and asking these really hard questions. Liz in Valley Glen, California, listening on K-Talk. Hey, Liz, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I just want to thank you for what you just said with Robert Kennedy. I went to school in New York, and it was always question. Question authority or question
right.
Whatever. But
yeah.
The reason I'm calling is I want to know why can't they go after Scooter Libby with the Patriot Act and then maybe Harriet Myers and Karl Rove? I mean,
well, they could. The reason that they haven't is because the Justice Department, up until very recently, was controlled by Alberto Gonzalez, and to this day is controlled by surrogates of George W. Bush, and that's why they're not going after him.
That's too bad.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a simple reality: is that they're not going to prosecute their own guys, and that's why Congress needs to and is, by the way, conducting, particularly Henry Waxman and John Conyers and Pat Leahy, are conducting some really vigorous investigations into this stuff, issuing subpoenas, threatening contempt of Congress. Frankly, I think that they need to use the power of inherent contempt. But, you know, Congress is moving forward on this, and they need to move more aggressively. Liz, you put your finger right on it. Thank you very much for the call. Let's see here. Shannon in Brainerd, Minnesota. Hey, Shannon, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me on. Well, I wanted to point out the coincidence that Gonzalez resigned the day the Daily Show and the Colbert Report went on vacation. I thought that was playing the press quite sneakily there.
What I think is an even bigger coincidence. That's an interesting one. I hadn't put two and two together on that.
I've never heard anyone say that.
That's a good one. But consider this, Shannon. Larry Craig, the guy with the wide stance, was busted back in what, June?
Yeah.
And here it is September, and I have not heard from anybody what the source of the revelation about Larry Craig was, but it happened the day after Gonzo resigned, or maybe 2 days after. I mean, as Gonzo was in the news cycle and as it was starting to look bad for him, as the stories were starting to come out about the crimes that he had committed and, you know, should he be pursued? And I mean, there was a lot of focus on Gonzalez and the Justice Department and Bush and the crimes of Bush that Gonzalez covered up. And all of a sudden, Larry Craig captures the headlines. I'm wondering if the Bush administration decided to throw a Republican under the bus because they knew that it was so salacious that it would steal the headlines even from, you know, the possibility that Gonzalez had been wiretapping Democrats, for example.
So timing it with the Daily Show wasn't enough. They threw in Larry Craig as a extra little added.
Well, it's your conspiracy theory. Yeah, your conspiracy theory plus my conspiracy theory equals, it worked out quite well for the Republicans, and that seems to happen a lot. Yeah.
The thing I wanted to ask Bernie, I don't know if anyone brought it up because I didn't listen to the whole Brunch with Bernie segment, was the Safe American Roads Act that was passed by the Congress in 411-3 back in, when was it? A while back. And now Bush is allowing the Senate never voted on it. And so Bush is now allowing these Mexican truck drivers to come into the country willingly.
Right. He's doing it under a pilot program.
What is the Senate going to do about that? I mean, I haven't heard. I was hoping to ask Bernie what the Senate is planning to do. Are they planning on having a vote right away about that? Because you know,
yeah.
So far,
I honestly don't know, Shannon. I just don't know. And you know, if you got a question for Bernie, call when Bernie's on. I don't know. What I do know is that the truckers, the Mexican truckers, are coming in under a program approved by, basically put forward by the executive branch, and it's because it's a pilot program, in quotes, with all these, quote, safeguards, end quote. So, you know, we'll see how these things have a way of turning into permanent programs. Jim in Newcastle, Washington. Hey, Jim.
Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
What's
up? Good morning. Well, you know, I don't know if you've had other people call in about something like this, but, you know, the Bush administration and their appeal, you know, Karl Rove cooked up all this deal for his religious base. This has had quite an impact on our family because we have a son that's, well, I call him a rabid Pentecostal, and he and his wife and mother-in-law just think Bush could walk on water. Then I have another daughter that's a Mormon. She's real nice, you know. She just does what the church says. Well, then I have another son that's an agnostic and another one that's Episcopalian. So I've really got quite a mess here. And to add more fuel to the fire, I have a daughter that is in the Assembly of God, and they just, you know, they just think George Bush is wonderful.
Sure.
And, you know, it's had an impact on our family. They mostly don't want anything to do with us nasty Episcopalians. Have you had anybody call in with something like this?
Yes and no, Jim. Not specifically as you laid it out, although that's, you know, this is almost a typical American family. There's so much variety in America these days. And the point that Bush's politics of division and Karl Rove's politics of division are echoing right down into our families and harming us is a very good point and well made. It's one of the reasons why Lee Atwater apologized for it on his deathbed. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
I've been working on vacation all the summer long, doing some intense relaxing just to keep our country strong. I've been seeing Condoleezza, Donald Rumsfeld too. Fox News said I'm still the greatest, so I guess it must be true. Iraq is going well, liberal doesn't sell, Bolton's in New York. I sit back and beam, Roberts is supreme, my revenge for Bork. Someone's been removing some brushweed, that someone is me. Someone's been removing some brushweed, the burden of the presidency.
500 days.
Got out of that hoeing and raking.
500 days, 11 hours, 3 minutes, 24 seconds. Until George W. Bush leaves office voluntarily, assuming that there is no impeachment. Ellen Ratner on the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen, what's going on?
Well, before I start in on the Petraeus report, I just want to say that former Senator Edwards, made a speech today where he was talking about U.S. counterterrorism operations, and that even that if he were president, he might even conduct them, even if we were not invited onto Pakistani soil. Now,
well, that's U.S. law, isn't it? I mean, I believe it was Joe Biden was bragging about the fact that he was the author or co-author of the legislation that allows us to basically go into any country and do whatever we want.
Right. But, I mean, and then if you take a look at what Obama had said, about 6 weeks ago, about how he may have more boots on the ground in that area, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if anybody thinks that all of a sudden you're buying a Democrat and it's going to be peace on earth, goodwill, you've got another thing coming.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's where it has to be us. It has to be all of us. Because, you know, just like Lyndon Johnson was not elected president to fight a war on poverty and to pass the most sweeping civil rights legislation in the history of the 20th century, by and large. He was not elected to do that. He did not run on that. And in fact, if anything, he ran on the opposite of that. He ran as a right-wing crack. He'd always been a right-wing racist cracker from Texas. But, you know, the people got out there in front of it and said, this is what we want. And that's what Johnson ended up doing. And you can go back and look at president after president after president. That's been the case. So it's just one more example of how we all have to get out there, get politically active, and be well-informed and be speaking out.
Exactly. There's no substitution for citizen action. Let's go on to the Petraeus report or the non-report.
Please.
Apparently, there's not going to be a written report, and his testimony, his written report, is essentially going to be his opening statement when he testifies before Congress. Now, what's so interesting and what we're hearing all over the place in Washington is the difference in the counting, how statistics are arrived at, whether you're talking about how much sectarian violence there is and what does sectarian violence mean. Does it mean Shiites on Sunnis or Sunnis on Shiites? And what happens about Shiites on Shiites or Sunnis on Sunnis? Because that apparently is not counted in the same way. The second issue is the question of Iraqi civilian casualties counted either by the Health Department in Iraq or by the United Nations, and the discrepancy in those statistics. For instance, in January of 2006, the government counted 549 Iraqis dead. United Nations counted 1,700. December 06, 2,800 Iraqis counted dead by the Iraqi government. By the United Nations, 1,900 or 1,927 counted by the Iraqi government. Huge discrepancies, and now, of course, the Iraqi government is not allowing the United Nations into their statistics and into their papers.
Hmm. Yeah, it's the books are being cooked. It's the bottom line. There are some very good sources. I think Progress.org, the American Progress Center for American Progress's blog, has done a very, very good job of just graphically presenting the numbers. There has been no decrease in civilian deaths in Iraq. There has been, if you look at year over year, there has been no decrease in U.S. deaths in Iraq, for that matter. And this is just all smoke and mirrors. And it's just, I think it's crazy that we are paying, you know, for example, we're paying Halliburton to pay truck drivers $150,000 a year in Iraq when you can hire an Iraqi to drive a truck for $4,000 a year, or five or ten or whatever.
Exactly.
And if we were to hire the Iraqis, they'd be building their own country.
Well,
instead of shooting at us.
You remember when I went to Iraq, I said, this is ridiculous. We're being served by people from, we're being served food on the basis by non-Iraqis, but people from Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka. Anyway.
Sri Lanka.
And,
yeah.
And so that's the kind of thing that's going on. But if talk about citizen action, everybody listening to this program should come up with a list of questions and send them to your member of Congress and your senator and say you want these questions asked. How are they arriving at these statistics? Who is making up the statistics? You know, why aren't more Iraqis being used? All these kinds of questions.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, it just seems to me that if we were to, everybody says if we pulled out, there'd be a bloodbath. I think if we were to pull out and take the same amount of money that we're using being there, which is what, about $2.5-3 billion a week, and
it's
simply
about $8 to $9 billion a month, probably.
Okay, and so if we took $8 or $9 billion a month and gave it to the Iraqi government and said, okay, rebuild your own country, start up your own cement factories, start up your own construction companies, hire your own local contractors, we're getting out of here, they would be putting their own people back to work. They would see
That's
peace in that country
exactly
so fast.
What we said when we were there in 2003. Because it is a contractor's war, and there is no reason in the world that if we had given every Iraqi member over 18 $40 a month, started a market economy over there, essentially, there would not be this crazy insurgency.
Right. But instead, we've got to give the money to Halliburton because, it's Dick Cheney's old company, you know, and buddies of the Republican Party. I mean, it's just an absolute and utter disaster from the get-go. Have you seen the movie New End in Sight, by the way, Ellen?
No. I've been meaning to, but I have not been able to go see things like movies because of my eyes yet. But
oh, I'm sorry. It's mind-boggling. It's no end in sight in the 11th hour.
Even the Fox movie guy told me I had to go see that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I hope your eyes are better soon and check it out. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Ellen, always great having you on the program. Thank you so much for being with us. Good talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Anything Goes Friday. Tom Hartman here with you on Air America Radio. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, the news, the headlines, it's interesting. There are a lot of headlines. By the way, welcome back to the program, the third hour of our program. A lot of headlines out there about how the suicide rate for 10 to 14-year-olds, for preteens and early teens, has gone up in the last couple of years. And there's an implicit commercial message behind this, in my opinion. For example, this one story, the suicide rate among preteens and young teen girls spiked dramatically in a disturbing shift that federal health officials say they can't fully explain. For all young people between 10 and 24, the suicide rate rose 8% from 2003 to 2004, the biggest single-year bump in 15 years, in what one official called a dramatic and huge increase. Okay, these are based on CDC numbers. And there's, you know, a lot of this out there about, you know, this is a terrible thing. And I'm on some of these listservs for psychotherapists, psychologists, psychiatrists, largely because of the books on attention deficit disorder that I've written and the consulting and whatnot that I used to do, and because I'm on the board of a school for kids with learning disabilities. One of the things I've been seeing is that the meme that is being put out to the medical profession is that a couple of years ago, back in 2003, I believe it was, 2004, the SSRI drugs, the selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the antidepressants like Prozac and whatnot, were required to be what's called black labeled. That you had to put kind of the doctor equivalent of a skull and crossbones on the prescription label that indicates that this thing can cause death. This is, you know, and that caused. Because there were these reports of increased suicides as a result of using these drugs, and possibly increased homicides. And that caused a lot of physicians, psychiatrists in particular, to stop prescribing SSRI drugs, and in some cases go to no drugs at all, or in other cases go to some of the older drugs, benzodiazepines and whatnot, or antipsychotics for that matter, that don't seem to be as appropriate for depression. And so the meme that's being put out by in my opinion, by the pharmaceutical industry, this is just, you know, their fingerprints are well concealed if this is what's going on. But I really think it's what's going on is that, hey, it's time to bring these drugs back because these drugs are incredibly profitable. They're all under patent. The vast majority of them are under patent. Very, very, very profitable drugs. And here's where it gets really interesting. Most of this has been based on this 76% increase in suicides among 10 to 14-year-old girls. And that's what has gotten all the headlines. Well, in 2003, 56 girls in the United States committed suicide. Out of over 300 million people in the United States, 56 10 to 14-year-old girls committed suicide, and in 2004 it was 94. And this is being used as a justification in the back channels that I'm seeing
in the psychiatric and psychological professions to encourage writing more prescriptions, hundreds of thousands of more prescriptions that are going to generate millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in profits for the pharmaceutical companies. And I'm just looking at these numbers going, wait a minute, 56 people in a nation of over 300 million and in 2003, 94 people in 2004. These are not statistically significant numbers. These are very, very small. This is such a small sample that it's subject to a tremendous statistical wobble. Any small, you know, I mean, when you have such a small number, any kind of variation is going to look huge if you express it as a percentage. So there's that. And then there's the issue of, you know, just depression in general. And this is an interesting one. I remember this was years ago, 15 or more years ago. And every time I talk about this, people ask me for the reference. And I'm sorry, I don't have it any longer. I quoted it in one of my books on ADD. I think it's called ADD Success Stories, a book I wrote probably 15 years ago. And we have moved twice since then. And a lot of my research stuff is in boxes in storage, and I just don't have it. But there was a report. It was actually a TV report. I believe it was on public broadcasting, where this group of people had looked at the research that, as I recall, Jane Goodall had done on apes and chimps, that, you know, she had observed, or maybe it was Diane Fossey, had observed that some of these higher primates were showing symptoms of depression just like humans do. And it followed a lot of the same patterns as humans. It was cyclical. It would come and go. An animal would have it and for a few months, and then, you know, a couple of years would go by and they wouldn't have it, and then they'd get it again. In other words, people were kind of taking turns having it. It seemed to afflict about 10% of the population, more or less, somewhere between 5 and 15%. That when these apes and chimps were monkeys were depressed, they socially disengaged, they physically withdrew to the perimeter, the periphery of the group. They didn't eat as well. They didn't sleep as well. They were hypervigilant. And so in the wild, in, as I recall, in Kenya, may have been in Tanzania, they went into, they were observing a troop of chimps. And they said, what would happen if we took out the depressed ones? What would be the social consequence? And so they observed them for a few weeks to identify that small percentage, the 5 or 10% that were depressed, and hit them with dart guns, knocked them out, took them away, and watched and said, you know, okay, let's see what happens now. And what they were expecting was that the chimps would all of a sudden go, hey, let's party hard. The bummer chimps are gone. The unhappy ones aren't around anymore. Let's all whoop it up. But what happened was that over the course of the next 6 months or so, as I recall, all of the chimps in that troop died. And what they found was that those chimps who were depressed because they had socially disengaged, because they had removed themselves to the periphery of society, of the chimp society, because they were hypervigilant, because they weren't sleeping well, they were the ones who first noticed the python coming through the tree in the middle of the night. They were the ones who noticed the leopard trying to sneak up on the group. They were the ones who sounded the alarm. And the lead psychologist who wrote this study, and I do remember of it, was a woman. I don't remember her name. And she, in her summary, she pointed, and she was a psychologist, she said, perhaps there are lessons for human society in this. If we look at the depressives among us, people who have struggled with depression, people like Franz Kafka or Albert Camus or Ernest Hemingway committed suicide, Winston Churchill, for that matter, although he wasn't, you know, that much of a great philosopher or literary figure, in some ways, I suppose he was. If we look at the depressives among us, aren't they the ones who are issuing the warnings? Just like those depressed chimps were, aren't they the ones that maybe we should pay careful attention to because what they have to say may be the warning that we need to be attending to? maybe just medicating depression out of ourselves all the time is not societally such a great thing. Now, on the other hand, depression, true, deep, clinical depression, can be a life-threatening illness and does need to be treated. And frankly, in my opinion, should be treated aggressively. And pharmaceuticals help many, many people. So I'm not, you know, this is not a Scientology rap or something like, you know, anti-drug. But what I'm saying is that what we need to do is consider this in a societal context. And consider that, you know, maybe there's more going on here than we know. The other interesting study, and I write about this in Screwed, is how the BBC did this study where they found that whenever the conservative governments came into power in the United Kingdom, they looked at back over 80-year period, whenever conservative governments came into power, suicide rates went up. Go figure. We're going to do a presidential straw poll right after the break. Right now, Lauren's going to go through and ask all of our callers who are on hold to call back. And for the next 15 minutes, I'm just going to pop you on the line. You will hear the phone ring and ring and ring. And then you will hear me say, okay, you're on the air. Give us your city and who you would vote for today in the Democratic presidential primary. We're going to do our Democratic presidential primary straw poll. And again, nobody's going to answer the phone until it's me, and you will be on the air. And just, you know, say, I'm calling from L.A. and I'd vote for so-and-so. 16 minutes past.
You're in the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman on Air America Radio.
Shishi, anything goes. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. My apologies to the people who had been waiting on hold. I know some of you had been on there a long time. But what we found is that if we announce that we're going to do one of these polls more than a minute or two before we started, there are some folks who start calling all their friends and saying, we want to get as many votes as we can in for this particular guy or girl or man or woman or whatever. And it ends up not being a clean poll. And so I just, you know, I'm springing it on you. So here we are, number 866-303-2270. You don't need to toss in your city. We'll just go through it as quickly as we can. David is getting ready to write it down. And I'm just going to put you on the air. And who would you vote for today? There you go. You're on the air. Who would you vote for today?
Either Al Gore or John Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. Who would you vote for today?
It's Lanny. I'm John Edwards.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama from Fort Wayne,
Indiana. From Fort Wayne, Indiana. Thank you very much. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. Who would you vote for today?
I believe I'm leaning towards Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards from Santa Fe.
All right, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I'm Jim calling from Wharton, New Jersey for president. Tom Hartman, but if you're not running, Dennis Kucinich.
Thank you. I'm definitely not. We recorded you for Dennis. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Hi. Is this?
You're on the air. Who?
Oh, I'm sorry. Donna from Oregon, and that would be Edwards.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
John Edwards, Shelton, Washington.
Great. Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for? Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. Our number 1-866-303-2270. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
San Francisco, John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Edwards. Next.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Joe Biden.
Okay, Joe Biden. Joe gets a vote. Who would you vote for today?
I'm Kathy from Seattle, and I'd vote for John Edwards.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. And who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
No CFR Prez, Ron Paul.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Who would you vote for today? No, that's not a sound we want to hear. Who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama, San Diego.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Patrick from Moclips, Washington, John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Hillary Clinton.
Hillary Clinton. Good. Finally a vote for Hillary. And who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama, San Diego.
You're listening to your radio, and that was not a vote for Obama. And who would you vote for today?
Kucinich.
Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. You had to listen to, well, I guess you had to listen to both, I guess. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Great, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Edwards, San Diego.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Barack Obama.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Hi,
hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Who would you vote for today?
John Edwards. This is Mike in Vancouver.
Thank you very much, Mike. And who would you vote for today?
I'll be in Atascadero, California. I'd vote for Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Two here for Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Yakima, Washington, John Edwards.
Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
This is James from Tacoma, Washington, KTPK, and I would go Edwards all the way.
Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Beverly Hills, Edwards.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
Okay, and you're calling from New York City, right?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Portland, Oregon, John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Calling from San Diego, California, John Edwards.
Okay, thank you. And next call, who would you vote for today?
Kucinich.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Philadelphia, PA, Kucinich and Edwards, and I love your show.
Okay, thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Edwards, Detroit.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Jan from Puyallup, Washington, John Edwards.
Thank you very much, Jan. And who would you vote for today?
Yeah, definitely John Edwards. He's the least politically vulnerable, and he can score a decisive victory.
Thank you, Jerry. And who would you vote for today?
Hi. Am I on?
Yeah, you're on. Who would you vote for?
Excuse me. Detroit, Hillary.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Gore and Edwards.
Gore and Edwards. Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich, Beaverton, Oregon.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Los Angeles, California, Hillary Clinton.
Thank you very much. And who would you vote for today?
Well, I don't know where the hell Biden's been. If he was out, it'd be him. I'm from Arcata, California,
okay.
And I'd have
great.
To vote
thank
for
you. For Joe Biden. And he's already got another vote. And who would you vote for today?
John Edwards.
John, okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich, Hillcrest, Washington.
Okay, thank you. And who would you vote for today?
Charlottesville, Virginia, WVAX. We want Edwards.
Okay, thank you. And last vote. Who would you vote for today?
Dennis Kucinich.
Okay, 27 minutes past the hour. We'll give you the total right after this.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Well, see, that's the one vote that the chat room in group more or less. I'm sure this is something that there will be a debate about for a long, long time. But the one vote that the chat room I'm recording for the chat room is speaking of attitude is for my cat Higgins, our attack cat. So let's see. Among the current candidates for president, the Democratic field. In the Tom Hartman Program straw poll today, we had, in descending order of how many votes the folks got. 26 votes for John Edwards, 12 votes for Dennis Kucinich, 4 votes for Barack Obama, 3 votes for Hillary Clinton, 2 votes for for Joe Biden, 1 vote each for Ron Paul and Al Gore, and 1 from the chat room for my cat. So there you go. Speaking of, before the break, actually in the last hour, I think I was talking about, you know, not being afraid and the Democrats needing to learn how to stand up. I just want to, if there are any Democratic politicians listening, I want you to step into the Wayback Machine here for a minute. 1968, you've got a president, a Democratic president, Lyndon Johnson, running an unpopular war, his vice president, Hubert Humphrey, running for election as president of the United States, and the opposition candidate, Richard Nixon, decides to take him on. And this is about a 60-second montage it's spliced, so it's little pieces of Richard Nixon's speech to the Republican National Convention in 1968. And there's a lesson in this for Democratic candidates. Assuming that I can play the thing here. Come on. Why is it not playing?
For 4 years, this administration has had the support of the loyal opposition for the objective of seeking an honorable end to the struggle. Never has so much military and economic and diplomatic power been used so ineffectively. And if after all of this time and all of this sacrifice and all of this support, there is still no end in sight, then I say the time has come for the American people to turn to new leadership not tied to the mistakes and the policies of the past. That is what we offer to America. Look at our problems abroad. Do you realize that we face the stark truth that we are worse off in every area of the world tonight than we were when we've had enough of big promises and little action? The time has come for honest government in the United States of America. And there is only one answer to such a record of failure, and that is a complete house cleaning of those responsible for the failures in that record.
There you go. Perk up your ears, Democrats. It's okay to stand up and speak out. You might even get elected. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Cassandra in Hollywood, California. Hey, Cassandra, welcome to the program.
Thank you. You know, I tuned into your discussion about depression, and I think I've got a little anecdotal evidence about some of what you were talking about. I come from I'm a fourth-generation military brat, so I come from a long line of military families. And the women in my family have all struggled with various forms of depression, including myself. And my mother was clinically depressed her whole life, but the Prozac generation of drugs actually kind of helped her. And then somewhere around that time, I think my father did this drastic switch to being a Rush Limbaugh guy, which was we were all rather moderate to left in our thinking. And now my mother is struggling so hard again with depression. And I think like your idea of the monkeys or the theory of the monkeys who were the hypervigilant ones, my mother's isolated with this man who she doesn't relate to anymore, and she depressed people a lot of times don't understand what's a reason to be sad. They blame themselves.
Exactly. There is a neurochemistry associated with depression, but there's also a neurochemistry associated with behavior. William James, the famous psychologist from, as I recall, the last part of the 19th or early 20th century, made the observation that if you stand up straight and put a smile on your face and go for a walk, you will feel better.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds incredibly, you know, simple, and it's so simple that it sounds dumb.
Yeah.
But there was a whole French movement back in the 18th century about this, you know, every day in every way I am getting better. People would recite that 100 mm-hmm. times a day, you know, but there's actually some truth to it. And the fact of the matter is that they now know from both EEG work and also measurements of cortisol in the blood and measurements of serotonin in the blood, that if you simply put a smile, a phony smile on your face,
right,
that you feel better, that you will have measurably higher levels of serotonin in your bloodstream over the following hour. If you simply put a phony smile on your face, and it also comes through on the radio, I mean, in television, I go out of my way to smile, because it comes through. I mean, it's not like it has to do with how your mouth is formed. There is a feedback loop here, and I think that some people get into a negative spiral, and the feedback loop becomes a negative downward spiral. You can also throw yourself into a positive upward spiral, and that's something that we need to work for.
Well, I mean, but think think about all of the families right now who have people serving so many rotations over there who are about hypervigilance and talk about where it's appropriate and where it isn't. I mean, I can't even imagine being in that situation. My grandmother went through it with my grandfather in Korea, but it creates this, I mean, talk about creating a negative loop. There's a film out there, I don't know if you've seen it, it's a documentary called Brats, I think The Journey Home, and it's about military children. And it compares what they're growing up with to growing up with a narcissist. And not to denigrate our troops, because obviously I wouldn't. I grew up in that environment. But the military takes over your parents' complete life, and you're secondary to everything in a way that a child of a narcissist would. And I guess I'm also bringing this up because if anybody out there knows family members, mothers, children that are dealing with this, and because a lot of them are reservists, they're not living on bases like they did in previous wars. I mean, it's time to reach out to those people and really do anything you can, whether it's helping with laundry and giving the family a time to go out or something, because this is a tragedy, a population that we are not even aware of is going through the complete decimation while their family members are being sent over.
Absolutely right. And the secondary effect of that, you know, the old saying from the Vietnam War, the war always comes home. I think it was Tim Buckley who wrote a song of that title or words to that effect. And that is that there's the rest of us who are not in Iraq, but who have the ability to have empathy. And, you know, I mean, that's a normal human experience. And we're experiencing that hypervigilance that our troops are. We're experiencing, obviously, not anything close to the level of of the family of somebody who's serving over there. But every time I hear a news report about, you know, another GI was killed, and frankly, every time I think about the civilians in Iraq, I mean, I've worked in war zones, and I've seen civilians killed in wars in Africa, you know, in Uganda when I was there. And I've seen civilians killed in essentially terrorist activities in Colombia with, you know, with bombings going off and I just, you know, it's, I think all of us right across the board and, you know, all any American who's,
if we're sensitive beings, we're going to feel it. I mean, we're
Be aware. That's right.
Most of us that are aware of what's going on in this war and haven't decided to be ostriches, we're feeling it. And it's, I just went home and visited my mom for this reason because I could sense every time I talked to her that there was something going on. And she's living with a man that she can't talk to about politics, which is completely unusual. They've been married for 45 years, and all of a sudden she's living with a stranger. And yet she's seeing these things on the news. And I'm like, Mother, and unfortunately her doctors are just drugging her. They're not giving her counseling. I'm like, you need to talk to somebody. What you're feeling is valid. There's a war going on and you're sensitive to these people. They go out and do USO work and they see the troops off in Dallas-Fort Worth and she can't do it anymore. And I'm like, of course you can't do it anymore. You know what's going on with those women that are standing there and saying goodbye to their husbands. And that's an appropriate response to what's going on in this world. It's not a depression.
Exactly.
It's not magical thinking. It's appropriate. We are in a crisis.
That's right. You're well said. Cassandra, I've got to move along, but thank you very much
for your call.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your right-on-the-spot points. Ed in Hillsborough, Oregon. Hey, Ed.
Hey, just kind of following up on the same thing. When you mentioned the primate study, it put me in mind of a study that I heard about a few years back that measured people's awareness of their own situation. And interestingly enough, the findings of this study were that people that were depressed actually had a firmer grip on the reality of their situation than people that were so-called normal. And going back to the thing about the depressed primates being more aware of the python in the tree or whatever, you know, it all kind of fits in the same, you know.
Yeah. Now, if we're remembering the same study, this was about 10 years ago, and it was on university students, and it wasn't on depression versus non-depression. It was optimism versus pessimism. And what they found was that the pessimistic kids, who tended to be often more depressed, there is a correlation, had a more accurate ability to observe themselves and had a more accurate understanding of how other people observed them, whereas the optimists tended not to have such an accurate observation of themselves and of the world around them. They tended to paint it with rosy glasses. But then the second step of the study, which I thought was particularly interesting, was that the optimists tended to be more effective in their lives and accomplish more throughout the course of their lives than the pessimists did. So the pessimists understood reality better, and yet it paralyzed them, whereas the optimists were not quite as in touch with reality, and it energized them. They pushed through, and they actually changed reality. So, you know, it's like boy, this stuff gets subtler and subtler, you know, as you get deeper and deeper into it.
Yeah, I hear you. The big question, you know, on a kind of a social level of should we be drugging reality away or not, though?
Yes.
You know, it raises all kinds of complexities, as you point out.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm very ambivalent about it, I have to say. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. It's obviously something that needs to be done in some cases, perhaps in many cases, but also I think we as a society need to be looking at, as Cassandra said, I mean, you know, if we have a society in a crisis right now, and crazy people running our government, and it's time for us to stand up and say, we're going to take this thing back. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hey, thanks so much to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Lopresto and Lauren Kirshner at Air America, to Stu Nethercutt, the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and in particular to you for listening to our program and supporting our sponsors and letting our radio stations know that you're listening and you appreciate the program. Thank you so much. 9.5 minutes before the hour, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And John in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, John.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, thank you for calling.
I'm here on KYNS. I thought it was interesting.
Great.
Right after the break, the first caller that wanted to speak to you about depression was named Cassandra.
Yeah. Yeah, the Greek myth of the woman who always told the truth and was always right but was never believed.
Exactly.
Was the story, as I recall. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And certainly one of the people who warned of the consequences of wrongheaded policies and suffered
right.
terribly from depression was Abraham Lincoln.
You're right. Yeah, Abe Lincoln, yes. And again, you know, you could argue that during the Civil War, that was an entirely appropriate response. You know, it was a crisis.
Yeah.
It was a horrible crisis. But Lincoln had suffered with depression through his entire life. He struggled with depression through his whole life. We now know. So it's interesting. Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Suicide. Thank you, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, John, for the info. Tom in Fresno, California. Hey, John. Tom. Tom, you're on the air. Tom is not on the air. Jack in Vancouver, Washington. Hey, Jack.
Tom, how are you, sir? Recently read your book, Screwed There, and liked it a lot. And
thank you.
Didn't agree with all of it, but the majority very much. And regarding the study that you had alluded to, the pessimism versus optimism, I just think it's completely rational to be pessimistic in light of the policies and the, the world stage, particularly terrorism, and that's going on.
Why? I mean, the reality, if you want to talk about what's real, you're far more likely to be killed by a drunk driver in the United States than by a terrorist.
Well,
so why step out of the house?
Statistically, that's, you know, you're right there. But
well, that's the real world.
Well,
I mean, you're far more likely, frankly, to be killed by lightning in the United States than you are by a terrorist.
At this point. At this juncture,
right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Can't disagree with that.
So I think that what's happened is that we're being force-fed a form of pessimism that is ultimately destructive. You know, there are two competing negative emotions that people experience. There are the dark, thick negative emotions. Like guilt and shame, And then there are the high-screening negative emotions like anxiety and fear. And both of them have to do with not being in the present. Both of them have to do with a person spending most of their time experiencing either past or future. And what's uniquely different about these two is that the people who are experiencing anxiety, this is fascinating stuff. When you talk to people who are experiencing anxiety, what you discover is that they are hallucinating or imagining a scary future. And they're imagining it with such vividity, you know, so vividly that it scares the hell out of them. And so they go into anxiety. People who are experiencing shame, guilt, grief, depression, the dark, thick, those people, they're remembering the past, and particularly those moments in the past when they've done something that they wish they hadn't done, and living in the past. And in both cases, because the person is not in the present, they experience these overwhelming negative emotions. And frankly, the cure for all of the above, and because certainly all of us have the ability to imagine horrible futures, and all of us have things in our past that we wish we hadn't done. I mean, this is the human condition. But the simple remedy, and it's not so simple, frankly, it takes practice. But I think it's the core of all religious traditions. The simple practice, the simple remedy is to be present. And there's a very, very powerful technique for doing this, and it involves becoming aware of all your senses. If you notice right now what you can see around you, just notice the colors. Wow. Isn't that incredible? And now notice the sounds that you're hearing. See, we're shifting senses now. Now notice the sounds. Notice the sound of my voice and the space between the words. And just notice the sounds in the room that you're in. And now notice the feelings in your body. And just notice what you're feeling. And then notice what you're smelling and tasting. And notice the passage of time. And notice your relationship to gravity. Are you sitting up? Are you laying down? You know, now your vestibular system. These are all our senses. And as you just cycle through that once or twice, what it does is it just takes that, you know, being in stuck in the future or being stuck in the past stuff and brings it to us, just pops you right out of it into this moment, into the present. And you're in the present going, whoa. And for me, and I can only speak for myself, but I, you know, I've heard many people share similar experiences. When I come to the present, when I'm right here in this moment, I'm astounded by how extraordinary it is. I mean, I just look around and life is such a miracle. What a gift we have. I mean, think of, you know, the cemeteries are full of people. Think what they'd give for just 1 minute of seeing what you and I are seeing right now, or hearing what we're hearing, or feeling what we're feeling. Just 1 minute of life. What an extraordinary gift. And I come to the present and say, wow. And I think this Tom Hartman's cure for depression and anxiety. Yes. You can patent. No, you can't patent it. But give it away. Monday, we'll be asking conservative Dan Gilbert to please take his Republican Party back. That should be an interesting conversation. Our Dean's brother, Jim Dean, the head of democracyforamerica.com, is dropping by, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. Thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. See you Monday.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.